This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening. Welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
I think Sudan now is on the brink of either a new phase or a chaos.
That's Nabil Nigem, a political analyst in Cairo, on Sudan's future. Details coming up also. In Libya, fighting for control of the capital city, Tripoli, escalates as casualties mount. And Algeria's parliament has nominated the head of its upper house as the country's temporary president. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, aid agencies are urging rival militias in Libya to take all possible measures to protect civilians as fighting for control of the capital city, Tripoli, escalates and casualties mount. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
In recent days, health facilities near Tripoli have reported 47 people killed and 181 wounded. The World Health Organization says 9 civilians, including 2 doctors, are among the dead. It says one doctor reportedly was killed while working as part of a field ambulance service. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says the agency has documented dozens of attacks against health workers and facilities that killed and injured 32 health workers and patients since 2018. He says targeting them is against international humanitarian law.
To respond to this spike in violence, the health sector pre-positioned supplies in advance in order to respond quickly and effectively. Emergency medical supplies and trauma kits were prepositioned in 4 strategic sites. The supplies are sufficient to treat up to 210,000 individuals for 3 months and to enable the treatment of up to 900 injuries.
Jazarevich says the WHO fears a prolonged conflict will drain the limited available medical supplies on hand. An added problem, he notes, is that the WHO is short of cash. He says the agency may not be able to meet the medical needs of the population if donors do not contribute more generously to its $43.5 million appeal. Meanwhile, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is appealing to all parties to the conflict to abide by their obligations under international law. Her spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, says the warring parties must take all possible measures to protect civilians and civilian infrastructure, including airports, schools, hospitals, and prisons.
The High Commissioner stresses that the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution must at all times be fully respected. Intentionally targeting civilians or civilian objects, as well as indiscriminate attacks, may amount to war crimes.
Shamdasani says the High Commissioner is particularly concerned about the welfare of thousands of refugees and migrants in detention centers near the combat zone in Tripoli. She says they are extremely vulnerable. High Commissioner Bachelet urges authorities not to abandon them. The United Nations Monday issued an urgent appeal for a 2-hour truce in the suburbs of Tripoli to evacuate civilians. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Protesters in Sudan today are accusing the country's National Intelligence and Security Service of attacking thousands of people gathered in front of the Sudan Army headquarters, calling for President Omar al-Bashir to step down. Reporter Naba Mohideen in Khartoum says 2 protesters were killed during a pre-dawn exchange of gunfire between the National Security and Sudanese Army soldiers who are protecting protesters.
The latest is many forces like student militias and security forces and riot police are trying to move protesters away from army headquarters by attacking them every 6 hours. And the attack at 2 a.m., at 8 a.m. every day, it's a very, very violent attack. some people are killed from the three sides, from security side, from army side, and from protest side. The latest thing is police forces just issued a communique saying that they will never attack protesters, and the sit-in is getting bigger, and the estimated number right now is 2 million people around the army headquarters.
This latest communique from the police, it could be from activists or it could be from anybody. What is the proof that this is coming from the police? Was this an official statement on a television or on radio?
The first thing, yesterday, Reuters interviewed the Minister of Interior. They said they confessed the number of the people killed. And today, media office of Sudan Police has just released it, not an activist, a very reliable communique. And eyewitness has noticed that this morning, like riot police, they didn't attack people. So only security and student militias are attacking army protesters and other people.
I've been watching the Sudan television this morning, and they are showing pictures of the garrison, the military headquarters, where there are no people. I mean, have you watched Sudan television this morning? Is that the clear picture of what is happening in Khartoum?
No, this is just a crap. This is bullshit. Sorry for the word, but this is crap. Because I have eyewitness, and I can send you, and I can tag you on live on Facebook, that 2 million at least of people are in headquarters. So this is very old photos. And this is the official governmental channel, so they must show this. But right now, all of my friends, my family, my colleagues, every journalist I know in Sudan is in the headquarters. So this is just crap.
And so you're telling me that military headquarters is now open to the protesters and they are camping inside there?
Yes, they are camping inside and they are protecting the bridges and the main streets leading to the army headquarters. They are protecting it from security.
And where is President Omar al-Bashir? It's my understanding that his house is inside the military headquarters. Where is he?
No, he's not in the military headquarters. Nobody is certain about where is he. But yesterday, he had a meeting with NCP, and they issued a communique at 9:30 p.m. And they said that they will just sustain the security of the country, and we will pass this crisis altogether. And just hours after that, after the communique, security forces and Islamic student militias attacked people.
What we are getting from the social media and the wires is that the military, the Sudan Armed Forces, is standing with the protesters. And the various militia and the national security are attacking the protesters. Yeah. Is that the right picture?
Exactly. 100% right.
That's Nahaba Mohideen, Sudanese reporter, speaking with John Tanza from Khartoum this past hour. Meanwhile, Defense Minister General Awad Abu Nuf acknowledged the reasons behind the popular protest. He vowed the army would prevent any slide into chaos. The protest organizers formed a council to open talks with the armed forces aimed at agreeing on a transitional government that represents the wish of the revolution. Nabil Nigim, a political analyst in Cairo, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the escalation in Sudan's popular uprising.
The Sudanese mainstream came to such conclusion. They want to just get rid of Mr. al-Bashir. After 30 years of failed politics, a difficult living standard, dividing the south of Sudan, so many factors generated such genius slogan, just fall, that's all. And I would like to just, emphasize that history keeps repeating itself, sadly, in this area. Dictators don't want to learn from the repeated lesson of the history. Mr. Bouteflika kept, resisting to listen to the people, and by the end, he is out. Mr. Bashir is just wasting time.
While Defense Minister General Awad Ibn Auf acknowledged the reasons behind the popular protest in Sudan, he vowed that the army would prevent any slide into chaos. What does that mean?
To be honest with you, it's just another local consumption, political speech. Sudanese people don't want to listen to such, cheap talk. I think Sudan now is on the brink of either a new phase or a chaos. I believe very much that Sudanese people are mature and they know exactly that they have to look after the stability of their country. So the way out is Mr. Bashir hands power either to military council, which will be able to launch a dialogue with the council, which had been launched by the opposition 2 days ago. And that body is the official body of the Sudanese mainstream opposition, or to a military council, which would start in 90 days the procedures to fold up the page of 30 years of regime.
As you said, the protest organizers had formed a council to open talks with the armed forces aimed at agreeing a transitional government that represents the wish of the revolution. Would the armed forces facilitate such a transition?
They will have to listen and they will have to obey the will of the people. And you cannot ignore the international community's reaction to what's going on in Sudan. The European Union said it is an unprecedented number of people have come out calling for change. And the people of Sudan have shown remarkable resilience in the face of extraordinary obstacles over many years. UK and UN have called for restraint and urged that the protesters' complaints be heard. Mr. Bashir, who has seized power in a military coup 30 years ago, on the other hand, faces genocide charges as the International Criminal Court relating to extensive human rights abuses perpetrated by Sudanese forces. So, Sudanese people are quite mature, they are intellectuals, and they are qualified to manage their affairs. All what we need now is that President al-Bashir should come to the reality of saying, enough is enough, peacefully hand over power, and come to an agreement with the Sudanese people, because this is the end.
That was Nabil Nagim, a political analyst in Cairo. He spoke to VOA's senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi about the escalation in the popular uprising in Sudan. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Eighteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. In Libya, fighting for control of the capital city Tripoli escalates as casualties mount. And protest organizers in Sudan have formed a council to open talks with the armed forces aimed at agreeing on a transitional government. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Algeria's parliament has nominated the head of its upper house, Abdelkader Ben Salah, as the country's temporary president. Algeria's constitution requires that power transfer to the head of the Senate if the president resigns. Although the move was expected, protesters who sought the ouster of former president Abdelaziz Bouteflika are unlikely to be satisfied. The Pan-Arab satellite network Arabiya reports that protests started again soon after parliament's announcement. Reuters reports that students in central Algiers were heard shouting, "Ben Salah, go!" Ben Salah will take power for a period of 90 days. During that time, officials are to schedule a new presidential election. Ben Salah called on parliament to work together so that the Algerian people may elect a president as soon as possible. Many people are watching what the army will do after permitting 6 weeks of mainly peaceful protests. Army Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Gaid Salah has expressed support for the protesters who are calling for political reforms to a system that has remained largely unchanged since the country's independence in the 1960s. Protests against Bouteflika began in late February after the president went to Switzerland for medical treatment. He has been in a wheelchair since suffering a stroke in 2013. The North African country is a member of the international oil cartel, OPEC. However, declining oil prices have limited the state's ability to provide subsidies and other benefits to voters. Uganda's Rwandan community has commemorated the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, which saw over 800,000 people killed in 100 days of ethnic majority Hutus targeting minority Tutsis. Many Tutsis fled to neighboring countries like Uganda, where Halima Atumani has this report.
The Rwandan Students Association at Uganda's Makerere University reenacts the bloody events that began in April 1994 by performing a play. They sing songs to remember the dead and to keep their memory alive. Rwanda's ethnic majority Hutus genocidal campaign against minority Tutsis left over 800,000 people dead in just 3 months. 10 of those killed were Jacqueline Uwamwiza's relatives, who dismissed her pleas that they join her in fleeing Rwanda.
And I was calling them, asking them, please, please, please go away, go to Burundi. People are waiting for you at the borders of Burundi. Please go, please go. But they were not believing that this will happen. And one day, I called again as I was doing it every day, and the phone was not responding.
Uganda has been a haven to fleeing Tutsis since the 1959 Rwandan Revolution, which changed Rwanda from a Belgian colony with a Tutsi monarchy to a free Hutu-ruled republic. It was from Uganda where now President Paul Kagame's Rwandan Patriotic Front launched attacks against Hutu forces, fueling civil war but also ending the genocide. On Sunday, Ugandans and Rwandans honored those killed in the genocide. They lit candles and vowed such bloodshed would never happen again. But Rwanda's ambassador to Uganda, Frank Mugambage, also stressed that a quarter century later, some wanted culprits are still free.
The arrest warrants have been issued, but indeed, in some cases, quite many cases, they have not been pursued. Efforts must therefore be made to expose the suspects so that justice and fighting impunity is realized.
Rwandan elders in Uganda worry that without this annual tribute, Rwandan youth who have no memory of the genocide may one day forget. George Bazatoha is a student at Makerere University and was born in Uganda after his family fled the Rwandan Revolution. He says the memorial is vital for his generation.
It gives me a spirit of loving my country and loving my fellow Munyarwanda, my tribe mate, without considering whether he's Hutu or Tutsi or Twa.
For Rwandans in Uganda, the ethnic and power conflicts that drove them out of their country and led to the 1994 genocide are tragedies they hope never to see repeated. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
25 years have passed since the Rwandan genocide that claimed the lives of an estimated 800,000 ethnic Tutsis and moderate Hutus. As part of the long journey to reconciliation, an aid group called Prison Fellowship Rwanda established several model villages where genocide victims and perpetrators live side by side as neighbors and even friends. Eugene Uimana has this report from one of the villages in Bugisira, Rwanda.
Louise Wamungu was 22 years old in 1994 when ethnic Hutus began slaughtering ethnic Tutsis, including eight of her relatives. Sitting inside her tin-roofed concrete and brick home in Bugesera, she shows a reporter photos of family members who were murdered during the 100-day killing spree. When authorities jailed the man who killed her cousin, she asked her brother, a prison guard, to take revenge. Wamung says she gave her brother a list of prisoners she wanted him to kill. She told him to set up a scenario where he was taking them out for routine labor. After going out, shoot them, she recalls saying. You would say that they were escaping. But Wamung's brother refused to murder the prisoners. And in 2007, Cyprien Tabalo, the man who killed her cousin, was not only released but became her neighbor. He says they found her cousin in the forest, trying to run. He fell down because he was very hungry, says Matabaro. I cut him twice with a machete, he says. Then he died. Matabaro, who admits to killing at least three other Tutsis, was one of tens of thousands pardoned as part of reconciliation efforts after the genocide. But moving into a village with his victim's family, he says, raised fears of further violence. After arriving in the village, I had the same worries, he says. But another attitude told me the presidential pardon will help in reconciliation. He asked his children when they came to visit him in the prison, is there any Tutsi who can talk with Hutu? But his children comforted him, Matabaro says, saying Hutus and Tutsis share drinks and even marry. Indeed, the genocide perpetrator and victim eventually became friends, farming and socializing together. Wamung says after Matabaro begged for forgiveness, he told her where he put her cousin's body. She realized they had buried all the bodies that were where he said they would be, she says, because they never accept that a relative has died until they have given them a decent burial. Built by faith-based group Prison Fellowship Rwanda, the village of Unity and Reconciliation in Wijesela became home to 110 genocide-affected families, similar villages. Jean-Paul Ntwari is the chief of operations at Prison Fellowship Rwanda. It was not easy to join two people who have experienced different sides of history, says Ntwari. The first challenge was trauma for survivors and self-restraint for perpetrators. Perpetrators did not believe they were actually pardoned, he says, while survivors feared that perpetrators could repeat history. But as we keep on encouraging them to do projects together, says Ntwari, those fears have gone. While the 1994 genocide tore Rwanda apart, the Village of Unity and Reconciliation is helping put the country and its people back together. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Bujesera, Rwanda.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, how has the foreign policy of the United States shaped its relationship with African countries? Former U.S. ambassadors reflect on the opportunities and challenges that Africa poses for the U.S. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.